And now, mis queridos, on to the Midwest. In Michigan, Governor Rick Snyder is already planning his reelection campaign. And one thing he's touting? The effectiveness of Michigan's right-to-work law, passed just over a year ago. That law, you may remember, spawned massive protests across the state. It also renewed national debate over right-to-work laws versus unions. Michigan became the 24th state to pass right-to-work laws. But there can be some confusion about what right-to-work means exactly and what it doesn't mean. To help explain, here's Latino USA producer Michael Simon Johnson.
Actually, I've never said unions are bad for business, and I don't believe this is actually anti-union. If you look at it, I believe this is pro-worker.
That's Michigan Governor Rick Snyder on MSNBC in late 2012 after he signed a law making his state the 24th right-to-work state in the country.
This is about the relationship between unions and workers, and this is about giving workers the freedom to choose, and unions have to be in a position to present a good value proposition. If you look at
Snyder, who is Republican, announced his reelection campaign this month. He's staking at least some of his hopes on the fact that his labor policy changes have brought over 200,000 jobs to Michigan, many of them in the manufacturing industry. In Tennessee last week, workers at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga voted by a hair to reject an offer by the United Automobile Workers to represent them as a union.
That between the two institutions, Volkswagen and the UAW, I know of not one incident of any aggression or animosity.
In doing so, they exercised Tennessee's right-to-work laws and their right to choose whether they want a union to represent them at all. And last September, a large group of mostly Latino fruit farmers in Fresno County, California, which is not a right-to-work state, protested their union, the United Farm Workers. They claimed they'd been unfairly represented, and they didn't even want a union.
They're not asking us if we want it or we not. They're forcing us to have the union, and we don't want that. We have that right to vote, to choose.
All this being said, unions are not yet a thing of the past. In fact, it is Latinos and other non-white groups that are shaping up to be the future of unions. In 2012, 156,000 Latino workers joined unions or took union jobs. But what these new unions will look like, how much influence and authority they'll have, and how lasting they can be, will depend greatly on right-to-work laws. But to understand right-to-work laws, we need to go back to where they came from.
Remember what the president said about Uncle Sam already spending at the rate of $100 million a day on this war? That's a lot in anybody's language. But before this war is over, we've got to double it.
During World War II, American labor organizations, from factory workers to railroad workers to coal workers, were largely committed to a no-strike pledge. There was a general agreement that ending the war by expediting labor was more important than whatever labor unions wanted.
Production is rolling, and every day new production lines are swinging into action, making things faster, faster and better, producing more for victory.
The American Federation of Labor, which would later become the AFL-CIO, even stated that to cease production is to strike at the very heart of the nation. But once the war ended, so did the no-strike pledge. All the pent-up tension between overworked, underpaid laborers and their employers, between unions and management, exploded in a wave of post-war labor strikes.
Western Electric employees swelled the growing total of striking workers throughout the country. Less than 15% of messages are being handled in the New York area.
Between 1945 and 1946, there were well over 9,000 strikes by about 8 million workers across the country. So Congress passed the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947, better known as the Taft-Hartley Act, to curb the power gained by unions.
The Taft-Hartley Act was written for only one purpose, to restore justice and equality in labor management relations.
Primarily,
it got rid of the clothes shop.
That's Moshe Marvit.
I'm a fellow at the Century Foundation, specialized in labor and employment law and policy.
A closed shop was when labor unions demanded that employers only hire union members. It was a way of securing union power over employers. With the Taft-Hartley Act, that was now illegal.
And what it did was it created the possibility of security clauses where the employer can hire anyone it wants, whether from the union or from outside the union, but within some time frame, that new employee has to join the union or pay the fair share provision.
That's called a union shop. And opponents of it argued that it created what's called a forced rider problem. Under a union shop, in order to work, you had to join a union, or at least financially support a union, even if you didn't want to. But the law had a loophole. It allowed states to pass laws banning union shops, and states that choose to do that are called right-to-work states.
In a right-to-work state, even if a union has won the election and represents the workers, if you are a new employee there, an old employee, you don't have to join, you don't have to pay any fees.
But even if you don't join the union still has to represent you and your interests as a worker, meaning you get all the benefits of being in the union without actually having to pay for those benefits. That's one way to define a right-to-work state. And this, of course, creates a problem as well.
It's just human nature that if you don't have to pay for something, you won't. It's similar to public radio in a sense. I thought of public radio because here in Pittsburgh, we just came off of a membership drive.
Because, you know, listening to public radio without donating is like eating a dinner at an exquisite gourmet restaurant and then not paying the bill, just walking right
and
out of there.
And it always strikes me that all the arguments they use on public radio about, you know, don't free ride, you know, pay for it, you listen to it all the time, you take it for granted, are the same arguments that unions have to make in right-to-work states. The only difference is on public radio, they essentially stop production. You know, you don't get the news as you normally would for that period where they have the pledge drive. Unions can't. They have to still represent all the workers. And so they really have no means to get a worker to pay. And so people just don't because, you know, why pay for something if you don't have to?
So where union shops created the forced rider problem, right to work creates the free rider problem. But there's more. Marvitt says that in the 1930s, part of the right to work movement was rooted in racism, a fear that encouraging unions would lead to economic partnership between working class whites and blacks. One anti-union Texas businessman even claimed that, quote, white women and white men will be forced into organizations with black African apes, whom they will have to call brother or lose their jobs, unquote.
If you look at the overlap of the states that have, you know, traditionally been the most racist and the states that are right to work, it's shocking. I mean, there's no denying that there is a relationship.
By that, Marvitt means that every former Confederate state is also now a right to work state.
I mean, that was one of the early and sort of remains in the backdrop of right-to-work laws even. The idea that's always put forward is this idea of forced association with people you don't want to associate with.
For undocumented workers, this is taken to the next level.
Undocumented workers can form labor unions, you know, just like anyone else, but if they're discriminated against for doing so and they take their claim to court like other workers would, they're not allowed to receive any back pay or any remedies because that would conflict with federal immigration law. So the idea being that they had no right to earn that money in the first place, and so they shouldn't receive, you know, any kind of remedy in return.
This all has led to speculation on the left that right to work's purpose is to drain unions by having so many free riders that unions can no longer afford to exist, while supporters of right to work argue that it's simply a matter of individual worker freedom. For Latino USA, I'm Michael Simon Johnson.